Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Good afternoon and welcome to Namaste Radio. I am your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are joined by Ron Garner for our third and probably our final installment talking about conscious health. Ron Garner has a Master of Science degree, a Bachelor's in Education, and a Diploma in Natural Health. He is a health researcher, educator, author, and speaker, and for a major part of his life, he worked in the public school system here in Canada, where he was a teacher, a principal, a deputy superintendent for the province of British Columbia, and he was also regional superintendent of schools in the Yukon Territory. And his own search for health solutions has convinced him that the human body is a miraculous self-healer if it is given the support it requires to build and maintain health. So we're so happy to have Ron Garner back on the show today. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Marie.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us and for the third discussion on conscious health. And now today we're going to be talking about some stuff that I believe is not yet in your revised edition of Conscious Health. This is new information, cutting edge. We're going to be talking briefly about cancer as well as the electrical needs for the body and some information about the thyroid, I believe.
No, this is carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide.
Actually the cancer update information and the carbon dioxide, the necessity of having adequate carbon dioxide in our body is in the book.
Oh, wonderful.
The other new stuff is by another doctor named Dr. Tennant, and he equates acid alkaline to voltage and how the body must have adequate voltage.
Wonderful. So now, Ron, what are these new discoveries that you've been researching and researching the work of doctors and cancer specialists, and what are they discovering now about cancer?
Okay, well, it depends on, you know, who you talk to and where you research. I would say, you know, as we have talked about in our previous programs, Marie, about how necessary it is to keep our bodies in an acid-alkaline balance. But when our whole body or part of our body moves into an acidic state, the oxygen levels decrease in that area, and it allows bacteria to take hold and to start to actually change the structure of those cells. And so specifically with regard to the little part on cancer, and I will give a disclaimer right here. I am not a doctor. I am not giving cancer advice. I am only reporting on information that I have researched about my understanding right now about the properties of cancer. And as it is in my book, I said people may want to read this information and then do more research on their own. It's only to point them in a new direction. But to go back into that, an interesting fact was that in 1931, Dr. Otto Warburg got a Nobel Prize for identifying the prime cause of cancer. And he said it was cell respiration. And actually, a little quote from him I could read. He says, "Cancer, above all other diseases, has countless secondary causes. Almost anything can cause cancer. But even for cancer, there is only one prime cause. The prime cause of cancer is the replacement of the respiration of oxygen in the normal oxidation process, oxidation of sugar in cells, in the normal body cells, by fermentation of sugar. He says all normal body cells meet their energy needs by respiration of oxygen, whereas cancer cells meet their energy needs in great part by fermentation. The difference between these two is the real difference in levels of oxygen. In every case during the cancer development, oxygen respiration always falls. Fermentation appears, and the highly differentiated cells are transformed into fermenting anaerobes, which have lost all their body functions and retain only the now useless property of growth and replication. Thus, when respiration disappears, that's respiration within the cells, life does not disappear, but the meaning of life disappears, and what remains are growing machines that destroy the body in which they grow. So that's really an interesting fact, which he says that as long as there is adequate oxygen there, cancer can't live. So that was identified way back in 1931. And we are talking about, you know, looking at the natural approach here. The pharmaceutical approach is look at how to kill the cancer cells, whereas what he is pointing out is that once the conditions are set in the body where oxygen levels in certain areas within the cells become low, then cancer can form. And part of the research that I did gave an indication that when pH within the cells is pretty near normal, 6.5 to 7, we have oxygen at optimum levels. But when the pH within cells falls down to, say, a pH of 5 or at about 4.5, where cancer evidently appears, but it can survive at a little higher than that, the cells are only able to produce about one-tenth of the oxygen. So there is the reason why the cancer is then able to proliferate. It sort of acts like plant cells, if you like. You know, it doesn't have the oxygen. It has low oxygen levels. Now, you say, okay, well, that's interesting. All we've got to do is increase the oxygen within the cells and it dies. Well, evidently that is true. And that's what a lot of doctors have worked at trying to accomplish in various different ways. But one of the other facts that I found out, and it really spoke to me, was that evidently cancer cells protect themselves with a thick fibrin coating, that's a protein layer, which is many times thicker than ordinary. So what we have here is evidently the cancer cells being quite smart. So they put this shield around themselves so that even though you increase the alkalinity within the body, it can't necessarily get into the cancer cells. In some cases, perhaps it does. An interesting man, a doctor, who did a lot of research on this, was a Dr. Emmanuel Revici, and he came to the States. He's dead now, but he practiced till he was 100, and he had great success in treating cancers. Well, he and other doctors like Dr. Kelly and Dr. Gonzalez, who I understand still practices, and he's a younger man, practices in New York. Their work goes back to a Scotsman by the name of Dr. John Beard in 1902. And when he really started studying cancer cells, he found that they acted just like the cells in a new developing fetus until the pancreas was formed in that fetus. And then that rapid cell division of the new little baby or the new fetus growing into a baby, when the pancreas is formed, then pancreatic enzymes appear to stop that rapid growth. It stops as soon as the pancreas is formed. So, you know, Dr. Revici took that information and he started to have success with it, but he found some other things as well. Now, Dr. Gonzalez follows that same work. But
what is it that the pancreas produces that stops the rapid cell growth?
pancreatic enzymes. So they evidently have an ability to stop that rapid growth. And Dr. Ravici also found that in cases of cancer, it's really related to pH, but he found that normal urine pH fluctuates in normal people, fluctuates every day on both sides of 6.2. But in cancer patients, he found that it got stuck on one side or the other. And so he worked very hard to try to correct that. So he used pancreatic enzymes to try to break down that fibrin layer, so then he could get minerals and lipids into the cell to raise the pH of that cell, and when the pH of the cell is raised, oxygen is increased, and the cancer then dies. So he used pancreatic enzymes, minerals, and certain oils to adjust the pH and to return the urine to this fluctuating pH. So that was interesting information, and I have reported on that in the book. More recently, or at least following up on Dr. Ravici's work, there was a man by the name of Kelly Edem, E-I-D-E-M. People can go on the internet and look up his name. Now, he wrote the book on Dr. Ravici about his life's work and his successes and the facts that he found out about cancer. And it's called The Man Who Cures Cancer. Now, interesting fact here, I'm not putting this out as an absolute fact. People need to research this own, make the decisions on their own. I'm just saying it's information that people might want to follow up on. Some years recently, after Kelly Edem had written the book, and he spent a lot of time learning from Dr. Ravici and understanding his work, Kelly was diagnosed with cancer himself. I forget which kind of cancer it was. So he got to thinking himself about how he could do it. He knew he had to break down that fibrin layer. He knew he had to get nutrients into the cell to raise it up. He knew Dr. Ravici broke down the fibrin layer, but the minerals and the oils, or the lipids as they're called, were introduced into the cell. Then it raised the pH, the oxygen increased, and the cancer died. So when he got his cancer himself, what he ended up doing was using habanero peppers or fresh organic ginger, very, very hot. And his theory was that these would break down the fibrin layer. And in his case, he says it absolutely did, because he cured himself of his cancer. Interesting website with lots of experiences on there from people. Now, along with that, he includes garlic and emulsified cod liver oil or primrose oil. My thinking on this is that garlic contains selenium, and evidently selenium has the property, when it's introduced into a cell, of raising the pH in the cell. So I'm not saying this is true or this is fact. It's information that I have read and that people can follow up and read themselves. But it's promising, to say the least, I think. And he said that he cured his cancer cheaply and quite quickly. Now, habanero peppers are extremely hot, so there's a process to go through there.
So I guess he wasn't able to just eat them directly, because that would really hurt your stomach, right?
No, evidently, I think what he did, he ground them up, spread them onto bread that had quite a lot of butter on it, so that helped to cool it a little bit. But he said, your mouth will be on fire. For people that can't stand the habanero peppers, fresh ginger evidently has the same properties to be able to do that, according to Kelly.
Hmm.
So
wonderful.
Quite,
and that's Dr. Eden?
No, he's not a doctor. Kelly, E-I-D-E-M. M is in Mary. Edem.
E-I-D-E-M, so people can Google him if they're looking for his website.
Yeah, they can, but I have that information with the with his name and some of his information in there that people can follow up on. They can go to my book and follow up from there if they wish.
Wonderful. And so moving on from the cancer, there's also some research from Dr. Buteyko.
Buteyko, yes. This is an interesting man. Dr. Buteyko was evidently born in the Ukraine, but he studied medicine and practiced in Russia. This is a number of years ago. And when he was doing his internship, when he was going through the wards, he made an observation that as people are nearing death, coming very close to death, their breathing increases. Not really interested in. Now, what was happening there? Then he started to research it, and he found that, if we breathe faster, we are taking in more and more oxygen. But he found that the carbon dioxide level within the body fell. Now, we've been sort of led to believe that carbon dioxide is a waste gas and we have to get rid of it. Well, that wasn't Dr. Buteyko's findings. What he discovered, that carbon dioxide is absolutely necessary to the release of oxygen out to the cells. And so he himself, when he was around 40, I believe, was diagnosed with life-threatening high blood pressure. And he was told by his doctors that he had about a year and a half to live. So according to his story, he worked at decreasing his breathing. In other words, increasing the carbon dioxide level in his lung tissues. Well, he lived to be about 80. He lived for about another 40 years. So that's quite interesting. And it led to, he made the conclusion that over 150 disease conditions are directly related to carbon dioxide deficiency. Now, this makes some sense, because what we've talked about before, and what we just did talk about a few minutes ago, about the importance of oxygen levels in the body. So if you can't get oxygen out to the cells, the oxygen level in those cells is lower, so bacteria and disease organisms can take hold, and that they love an oxygen-poor environment.
So, Ron, are you saying that when we don't have enough oxygen, we also don't have enough carbon dioxide?
That's what Dr. Buteyko was saying, exactly. Now, he then moved along to teach people about how we can check your carbon dioxide level on your own and then move to increase it. And on the internet, people can find the Buteyko breathing exercises and practices. But he developed what's called a control pause to determine your level of carbon dioxide. And I have this information in my book with a chart, too. A control pause is simply this. As you sit in a chair, there are licensed practitioners of the Buteyko method who can teach this properly. I am not teaching it here, but I'm giving a description of it. That if you sit in a chair and you breathe normally and you're breathing regularly, and then you breathe out approximately about 90% of the air and you hold your breath, and then you count the number of seconds with a little stopwatch or your watch to see how many seconds you can go comfortably before you have the first urge to take a breath. See, this isn't a how long can you hold your breath thing. This is how long can you comfortably go without taking a breath. And as soon as you feel like taking a breath, you stop the watch, and there it is. That's the number of seconds. That is your control pause. Now, out of this, then he developed a chart, which is in my book. and that if you are able to go 5 seconds, you are there's only 3.5% of carbon dioxide in the lungs. A fully healthy person has 6.5% in their lungs. That's a person who will have no disease symptoms, problems at all. So as it goes through here, 20% is the first level of where we start to see, well, we'll still have disease symptoms. 40 second pause is what he calls the threshold where good health starts. And so it's a matter of how many seconds that you can go comfortably without taking a breath. And the more you can means that the more carbon dioxide is in the lung tissues.
So, Ron, 40 seconds sounds like, I mean, I could definitely hold my breath for 40 seconds, but I'm guessing I would probably feel like I would like to take a breath sooner than that. So, I mean, it sounds like an awfully long time.
It certainly does. Well, here's his description. Less than 10 seconds, he says, we have serious health problems. 10 to 25 seconds, it's an unhealthy state. And there are disease symptoms evident of one sort or another. And that 40 seconds is the threshold of good health, and the 60 seconds is the marker of excellent health. And he found no diseases of civilization in people who could go 60 seconds comfortably. And he even went further than that, 80 seconds and above, people then move into an area that he says gives them super endurance. Now, I was speaking in Campbell River about a month and a half ago, and we did this exercise in the audience. Most of the people were probably around the 20 to 30, 35 level. There were a few people that were 40 and over, and some of these were athletes. There was one person who was over 60, and that audience had about 95 people in it. So you're right, you know, the general population, I think we have been told deep breathing, and we have not understood what Dr. Buteyko found. So go ahead.
Ron, I mean, we can measure how unhealthy we are, so then what do we do with that information?
What do we do with that information? Well, we make the decision of whether we want to be able to increase the carbon dioxide levels in our lungs.
Mm-hmm.
That if carbon dioxide is deficient, then the circulation is decreased to the entire body. All the organs, and including the brain, are forced to function at lower levels of efficiency. So what are the causes of low carbon dioxide? It's hyperventilation or deep breathing. And secondly, and I was guilty of this all my life, mouth breathing, breathing through the mouth. I had had asthma problems and allergies, but I just got in the habit of breathing through my mouth. And when you do breathe through your mouth, you take in more oxygen, you take in lots of oxygen, but you get rid of the carbon dioxide that needs to be in there as the releasing factor of oxygen getting out to the cells. The third factor is sleeping on your back. Now, I found this out about a year ago, so since then, I don't sleep on my back now. I don't think I mouth breathe anymore. When I used to sleep, I was often on my back, and I'd have to have a glass of water beside me and wake up once or twice in the night to have a drink of water because my mouth was so dry. Well, what was happening is that I was deep breathing all the time.
So it's interesting. It sounds like there's kind of, I mean, some people I've heard feel like they have cured themselves of cancer through deep breathing, and now I'm hearing the opposite. I mean, it seems like there's so much conflicting information. I know every time I go see my chiropractor, she wants me to sleep on my back.
Oh, really? Well,
for my back health, maybe not for my breathing, but... because it keeps my back straight.
Mm.
So there's so much conflicting information. I guess that's why we really have to research more in depth.
We have to take responsibility for our own health, and we have to do our own research and make our own decisions. Correct breathing, according to Dr. Buteyko, is that less is better. In other words, through the nose at all times. Shallow breathing, I mean, once in a while, if you feel sort of, you know, oxygen starvation or something, you can take a deep breath and it feels good. But shallow breathing, even when we're walking, and that's a place to practice this, light, slow, and easy. So the way to increase the carbon dioxide levels is that we breathe shallow enough that we feel a bit of an air hunger, but we can get through that for a minute, and then we take it again. If you go on Buteyko breathing practice sites, you will find their instructions, which is, you know, take your control pause, which we talked about a minute ago, and then reduced what he calls mouse, like the little animal, mouse breathing. When he's teaching children, and the practitioners now, they say, pretend that there's a big cat on the other side of the wall and you're a little mouse. And you don't want them to hear your breathing. So you take really tiny, slow, quiet breaths. And you do that for 5 minutes. And you're going to feel this sort of air hunger. And then you breathe normally for 1 minute and take your control pause again. And you'll find that control pause is higher than it was before. So that's kind of confirmation that we're on the right track. And they say that we should repeat this three or four times a day for several months. And then once you get your control pause up to where you want it, say above 40, then you can do that once a day. But it might be a good idea to get training from a qualified Buteyko instructor, too.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that information. It's definitely something that we can all look into and see if we feel it's right for our needs. So now let's talk about the work of Dr. Tennant.
Dr. Jerry Tennant, yes. Interesting story. He was still is, but he doesn't practice in that area now, an ophthalmologist, and he has many patents for very delicate eye surgery. And he, over time of working with his patients and doing eye surgery on people that had viruses in their eyes, he found later on when he got ill that he had been inhaling these viruses. Well, he became extremely ill and tired, and he found that there were probably only a couple hours a day when he could think clearly enough. And so while he was thinking, he knew about acid-alkaline balance, but he also knew, as we've talked about and I talk about in my book, that everything in the universe is electrical. Everything in our body is electrical. We're talking about oxygen, and we talk about all the nutrition we need and we eat, but everything in the body is converted into electricity, into voltage in the body. So what Dr. Tennant found was that all the cells in our body operate in a narrow range of chemistry, which we need that, the pH, we talked about that before, Marie, and electricity. We know that blood cells need to operate in a narrow range of about 7.35 to 7.45 pH. But Dr. Tennant went a little further, and as far as I know, he is the one who has put forward this new book. Not a new book, but he has his own book through his company. It's quite an expensive one, but it's called Healing is Voltage. And Dr. Tennant said that acid alkaline is really about voltage. Now, that makes sense, because if everything in the universe is about electricity and everything in our body is about electricity, he found a conversion factor where we can talk about acid alkaline, and that really means voltage. So that when the pH of the cells in our body are, say, in around the 6.5, 6.8 to 7 range, that's normal neutral, that in health then, cells have a voltage of minus 20 to minus 25 millivolts. So, and then if we injure ourselves, for instance, he says, then the body will increase that negative voltage up to about minus 50 volts. What does this do? This increases the circulation of nutrients to that area, and then it will drop it to do the healing, and then it drops back to normal. But as we move into a more acidic state within the cells, remember, acid alkaline equates to voltage, we start moving towards positive voltage, positive millivolts, and that's where we then start to experience illness. So what he found that acid foods, beverages, drugs, whatever, they are electron stealers. So if we think of our body and every cell in our body being like a little battery, a little voltage battery, so acid items that we take into the body are electron stealers, whereas alkaline items, raw fruits, vegetables, alkaline minerals, these are electron donors. In other words, they put more electricity into our battery.
So, Ron, I'm just going to stop you for a second because I'm not totally up to speed on my science and my chemistry, but free radicals, those are the electrons that are floating around, aren't they? When we talk about anti-aging and they say, the free radicals are what's causing the aging. Does that have something to do with
electrons? It probably does. To eliminate or to reduce free radicals, we need to use the antioxidants. So, yes, they are related, but I'm not sure that I am the one to explain the relationship of that.
Okay.
in healing, you know, as I said, the body will increase its voltage. But as we move towards illness, when we think of minus 25 millivolts being normal, minus 15, we start to get tired, minus 10, we get sick, minus 5, we don't have the energy to keep working. And then past zero, as we move into the positive millivolts scale, the cell polarity changes. And if we get up to plus 30 millivolts, or down to it, if you like, we are now in cancer territory.
Mm.
So, again, it's a matter of acid alkaline, keeping our body as close to neutral, as alkaline as we can, to prevent disease. To heal, Dr. Tennant says we need to get electrons back to make new cells and get well. And he says that chronic pain is really a symptom of low voltage, and that when the voltage is increased, the pain leaves. So what are the electron donors? They're raw vegetables, antioxidants that we can buy as supplements, and the interesting fact that one of the main electron donors is exercise, moderate exercise. He says that muscles are electron generators, and the muscles are our rechargeable batteries. So that's why it's really so important that we have some exercise every day. Walk for 30 minutes is absolutely a wonderful thing to do, not only because it increases our circulation, but what I didn't know before, we're actually generating electricity within our body. Now, this doesn't mean, you know, exercising to the point of making ourselves overtired.
But it sounds like, exercise has so many benefits. A minimum of 30 minutes of moderate exercise a day, it helps with, I mean, it helps keep your weight down, it helps with your mood, and now it sounds like you're saying it helps to actually generate these extra electrons that help.
Which probably at the basic level, that's the most important thing, which Dr. Tennant says. If you've got the voltage in your body, you're healthy. If you don't have it, you're not. So, absolutely, it is so important. There's always more to uncover and realize. Dr. Tennant points out that as far as water is concerned, as the voltage rises, another way of saying that is as the alkalinity rises in the water will hold more oxygen. And as the voltage drops, the oxygen begins to disappear. And since our cells are 70% water and they need oxygen to operate properly, this is so important. You know, most water that people drink, for instance, bottled waters, if you take the pH of that, you'll find it's acidic. So we realize then, after the fact, that that's an electron stealer. So we really need to be having water at a neutral pH or slightly alkaline because we are increasing the oxygen in our cells. Another thing, another way that Dr. Tennant explained this is he says, as far as bugs, he calls them viruses and bacteria, he says there's about 1 trillion bugs that are kept under control when we have adequate cellular oxygen. But when the oxygen levels drop in our body from low voltage, the bugs will multiply and produce their own toxins and damage other parts of the body. So when the voltage drops, we get pain, low oxygen, inefficient metabolism, and as he says, the bugs having lunch on us. And that, he says that when, if we treat an illness with antibiotics or drugs, as soon as they're finished, we get through that crisis, we're still left with a body that has low voltage and low oxygen, and the bugs will start multiplying again. So we need to take action to correct our lifestyle, our diet, and that's what conscious health is all about, to show you what is, what are the good foods, what are the bad foods, and from Dr. Tennant's point of view, it's a matter of what are the foods that are going to contribute voltage to your body and what are the ones that are going to be electron stealers.
Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine that the electron stealers are the ones like that you were talking about last week, the five deadly, the white poisons.
Oh, absolutely. The sugar,
like
salt, white flour, white rice, and even pasteurized dairy. They are all, in the end, electron stealers, except for the milk, which has some nutrition in it. The others have no nutrition, but they just contribute to acid conditions in our body. The body works really hard to try to cleanse itself out. So even with surgery or pills or supplements, without adequate voltage in the body, healing doesn't happen. So the two of them go hand in hand.
So, Ron, it looks like we have a little bit of time left to talk, because I know at the beginning, before we started the show, we were going to touch on these three topics. But there are some other topics that we were going to discuss if we have time. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about the voltage?
Sure. I would just like to continue a little bit more on the low voltage. Low voltage can be caused by not having enough stomach acid, that's hydrochloric acid in our stomach, because that's needed to digest proteins. And as we talked about in a previous program, as we get older, the production of acid within our stomach tends to fall. People in their mid to late 60s have about one-third of the stomach acid that someone at the age of 25. And this aspect of low stomach acid starts to lead us into another subject, which we have a little bit of time, and that's getting into the thyroid area. So if we have a little bit of time, we can move into that. Is that okay?
Yes, definitely. You have some information about even how the thyroid can affect the fluorine and chlorine in your body, and also how you can check for low thyroid.
Yeah, I do. So here again, finishing off in the stomach acid, is that in order to produce stomach acid, Dr. Tennant points out that we need iodine, sodium chloride, carbon dioxide, water, and vitamin B1. But that first one is iodine. Now, we know that iodine is related to the thyroid. Now, in order to increase hydrochloric acid in our stomach, we can supplement before meals. We can take betaine hydrochloride, which is hydrochloric acid capsules that you can buy in a health food store. And he says we need to take that with foods or medications for several months to increase the stomach acid. Now, as we do that, as we increase the stomach acid, so it's available then in the stomach along with digestive enzymes or enough raw food, the food is going to break down more completely and the body is going to be able to get the nutrition out of it. Interesting thing that Dr. Tennant found. He said 70% of his patients are sick because of their teeth. Mm. And that's because dental problems, because a lot of teeth have mercury amalgams in them and root canals.
And it's interesting because I've actually heard that root canals are not healthy for you, and I had to have a root canal, and I talked to the dentist about, because I heard that it was healthier to just remove the tooth. And the dentist said, no, it's healthier to have a root canal. This is the research that we've done. And so he convinced me to get a root canal.
Yeah. I ran through the same thing, and it was about 12 or 14 years ago. And I pushed through, much to the disgust of my dentist, and I had my root canal tooth taken out. So, but as far as mercury, it's an extremely toxic poison, and I'm going to get to its relevance here. And if we have those silver fillings in our teeth, whenever we chew food, have hot drinks, brush our teeth, it releases mercury into the body. It's a strong poison. And among the prime cellular targets of mercury are the mitochondria, that is the energy-generating centers in the cells. So every tooth is on an acupuncture circuit in their body. So depending on which tooth it is, it might be on the heart meridian or the pancreas or the lung or the liver or the kidney meridian. So the problem in that area, an infection in that area, also affects those other areas and has a debilitating effect on those. Now, root canals, there's a very interesting book written by Dr. George Meinig, M-E-I-N-I-G, called Root Canal Cover-Up. And I talked to him probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and he was in his early 90s at that time. I don't even know whether he's alive now. But what he discovered and pointed out, and we can think about this and make a decision yourself whether you think it's logical. When we take a tooth that has been diseased to the point where the dentist doesn't feel that he can save it anymore, he can't fill it anymore, then they drill down and they take all the decay out of it, and they also remove the nerve right down to the bottom. So what happens here? That tooth is now dead. It doesn't have any blood circulation of its own. So therefore, it can become infected, or even decay spread around the tooth can come into the jaw area. University of Kentucky study found that one root canal tooth can shut down at least half of the immune system in that area. Interesting thing, in Dr. Meinig's book, he had magnified pictures of teeth. And when blown up to 1,200 times its size, a tooth just looks like almost like a honeycomb. All kinds of little tubes and holes in there. It's not a solid thing. It is porous. Now, if we don't have circulation running through the tooth, with the immune system being able to operate on it, Dr. Meinig then said that is an ideal safe haven for bacteria to hide and multiply. And when they get to be too many and we have an illness, then the bacteria can migrate to other parts of the body.
So, Ron, I'm curious, what do you do, like, if, because we can't just walk around with missing teeth. I mean, do you get, like, a dental implant, or how do you, if you choose to go the opposite of a root canal? Because if you're needing a root canal, anyone who's ever needed a root canal, I mean, you need it bad. You're in extreme pain. I mean, there were a long time my dentist was saying, oh, you might eventually need a root canal. You might need a root canal. When it got to the time where I actually needed the root canal, I was practically begging for it. I mean, I was in so much pain. So you can't just not address it. You can't just leave it untreated.
Absolutely
so
not.
If you have the tooth removed, then what do you – because there are, like, dental implants that you can get where they actually put, like, spikes into your jaw. I mean, are those any more or less dangerous?
I'm not an authority in that area, but that would be a solid piece of metal, so bacteria cannot get inside them and multiply. So, you know, you could look at that area yourself. In my case, it was the lower tooth right at the back of the mouth. And at first, I sort of missed it. Now I don't even know that it's gone. If it's one of the teeth that are further in and they have teeth on either side of them, then, of course, that can be bridged. But, you know, those are questions between you and your dentist and you and your own research.
All right. Well, and it's just because it's interesting because the dentist, I mean, if you say to your dentist, well, I don't want a root canal because I've heard they're unsafe, they, in my own experience, they will say, well, this, in our opinion, is the safest thing for you to do.
Yes, I realize that, and that's a personal decision you have to go through and make. My dentist was disgusted with me. He says, why would you move part of your body? Well, I made the conclusion it wasn't a functioning part of my body. So it is a controversial subject. I'm only presenting both sides here so people can make up their own minds. But so if we want to move on now here to get into, what have we got here? We've still got, according to me, 13 minutes.
Yes.
A number of symptoms here. We're going to move into the thyroid area. Decreased circulation, feeling cold often, cold hands and feet, cold and heat tolerance, dry, itchy skin, asthma, frequent colds, fatigue, lack of energy, weakness, eczema, hair loss, high, you know, heart problems, high, all kinds of things. Many, many symptoms. As I learned from Dr. Tennant, that the thyroid hormone controls body temperature about 40% and voltage about 60%. So if we have a low-functioning thyroid, we're probably feeling cold, and our voltage is lower than it should be. So therefore, our circulation and the cellular detoxification is low. Dr. Tennant found that 90% of his patients, and he put that forward to the general population, that 90% of people are hypothyroid and don't know it because they're deficient in iodine. It's just this, it's not in our foods now unless we're eating a lot of seafood. So how you can test for this of your body temperature, and he says it's the most accurate indication, and I'm going to, this is also corroborated by the work of Dr. Mark Starr, that if I have time, we're going to talk a little bit about that. The most accurate indication is your basal body temperature. That's in bed before you get up in the morning. You take your temperature under the armpit, not under the tongue, because any kind of a sinus condition, a cold condition, there's an elevated temperature in the head. So normal temperature in Fahrenheit under the armpit should be 97.8 to 98.2, whereas normal body temperature is 98.6. or in Celsius, 36.6 to 36.8. Now, below these, he says, is hypothyroid. And when you need, when you are hypothyroid, you feel like you need a spark to keep you going, to get you going. Sugar, coffee, a cola, a Red Bull. So that is, can be one of the indications that maybe there's a thyroid problem here. Dr. Tennant also says that high cholesterol is a symptom of not enough hormones in the body because the thyroid's not working properly, or we're consuming too much soy, or the body has too much mercury. Getting into the thyroid a bit, the body needs iodine, selenium, zinc, iron, and progesterone, cortisol, and glutathione to convert T4 to T3. Now, it's getting a bit technical here, but if people go to their doctor and they want to have thyroid tests, there are actually four thyroid hormones, T1, 2T, T2, T3, and T4. T3 is the active form that does the work in the body that will work to change our temperature and increase the metabolism. T4 is the one which will convert to T3. Now, as far as iodine is concerned, it's really very important. The thyroid needs it to function normally, and it, the thyroid, will get it first when it comes into the body. Dr. Tennant says there's no bug that iodine cannot kill, and that the body places 30 times more iodine in the skin than in the blood to prevent infection from the outside. So that's why we sort of have a protection around us. And he says if you're not eating seaweed every day or supplementing with iodine, then you are likely deficient. And here's the interesting part where we're getting into chlorine and fluorine. That iodine is on the periodic table of elements. Iodine is a halogen, and it's displaced by elements, halogens, above it in the periodic chart. So iodine is down as number 4, and above it, we have bromine, chlorine, and fluorine. And any of these can displace iodine in the body. So fluorine's the worst. And it's in city water if it's fluoridated. It's in a lot of toothpaste, dental teeth coating. And it's also found in soy. Fluorine displaces iodine and makes a fake hormone, which makes thyroid blood tests look normal, but it's not. This is according to Dr. Tennant. So drinking chlorinated water also does the same thing. So that's why it's really necessary that we have pure, clean water and that we avoid things that contain chlorine and fluoride, fluorine.
So, Ron, it's interesting what you're saying because when I went to my doctor for depression, and the first thing they do is they check your thyroid. But if you are having these, the chlorine and the fluorine levels are messing with that, then the test, you actually could have a problem with your thyroid, but the test will come out fine. Is that what you're saying?
That's what he's saying. It'll look like it, but it's not. And the reason you can tell is that, you know, your body temperature still isn't right. You're still having these other symptoms. It takes a lot of work to try to track that down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this also, I have found in my own experience that I had been to doctors a number of times saying, you know, I'm cold. I'm cold all the time. Okay, well, we'll do a thyroid test. So they did a thyroid test, and one of the tests they look at most is the TSH, which is thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that's not produced by the thyroid. It's produced by the pituitary gland to try to force the thyroid into producing more hormone. So the higher that is means the more deficient your thyroid is. The interesting part of that is that many medical practitioners misread that, and this is according to the work of Dr. Mark Starr, that it should be a very low level, very near one. Now, I had TSH readings up in the threes and even into the fours, and since the lab tests say it's a range of 0 to 6, they say, oh, well, you're within range. But rather than trying to argue with tests and that is, but I am still cold, I still have these symptoms. So what's going on here? You know, we still have a couple of minutes yet here. Getting into Dr. Mark Starr's work. Dr. Mark Starr wrote the book, and this is the one where I learned a lot from. It's called Hypothyroidism Type 2, The Epidemic. So he says that type 1 is a failure of the thyroid gland to produce enough thyroid hormones. It doesn't have adequate iodine, can't get it. There's too many other things competing for it. But what he discovered was that there is a type 2, and that's a resistance to thyroid hormones at the cellular level, and it's not detected by blood tests, and it's made worse by environmental toxins. And he says that of all your hormones, the thyroid is the most important. And what he found that was that hypothyroidism type 2 is not understood by most doctors. And here's the part that I found that was very interesting. It's caused by infections of ourselves or even our ancestors, which damage the mitochondria, that's the energy-generating parts in our cells, and the deficiency is passed on from mothers. So each generation that escapes death from infection has weaker mitochondrial DNA, and that's why he and Dr. Tennant suspect that 90% of the population are hypothyroid to some extent. Now, Dr. Mark Starr found that the only thing that could correct this is desiccated thyroid, that the synthetic thyroid doesn't do it.
So you have to take supplements of other people's thyroid? Is that what you're saying?
No, not other people's thyroids. But you have to, first of all, find a doctor who does understand this material. And if not, maybe get Dr. Mark Starr's book, find out on your own. And then I am fortunate now, in the place where I live now, I have a doctor who absolutely understands this. And he wants my levels at or near the one. I'm slightly above that yet. I have increased my body temperature. But it wasn't happening on the synthetic thyroid, the synthetic T4, which is called Synthroid or something. But desiccated thyroid comes from pork thyroids, which evidently is almost identical to humans. And so with the proper adjustment, working with a doctor who knows about this, I'm not saying you can't do it on your own because you need a prescription. So you have to find someone who understands this, and gradually, by supplementation, you can return this. Because I realize that my mother was not a well person. She'd had infections, so this was probably passed on. I've had them myself. So I have had deficient functioning cells, mitochondrial cells, that have been generating insufficient energy or the energy molecule. And it's directly related to oxygen, again. So if it's generating energy properly, if there's enough oxygen available, one unit of fat will produce, according to him, 38 units of energy. If it's not available, it goes down to one or two. It's like running a car from a 38 miles a gallon down to 2 miles a gallon, or anywhere within that range. So how to prove thyroid function? Get iodine. You might even be able to talk to pharmacists and learn something about that. And that evidently needs tyrosine and vitamin B1 with it to increase your iodine levels. Many people can correct their problems that way. Desiccated thyroid, we need a doctor who really understands that. And you need to work on your stomach acid as well.
So, Ron, we're running out of time here. We're almost out of time. So I just want to talk about, really quickly, go over which of these topics are covered in more depth in your book, Conscious Health?
The topics on the cancer highlights and the carbon dioxide. the part that we're getting into the thyroid and the electricity of the body, that is the work of Dr. Tennant and Dr. Mark Starr's book called Hypothyroidism Type 2. And if people want to follow up, they can go there. The other part and all the basics on how to improve the nutrition in your body, how to detoxify and help the body heal itself, that's all in my book.
Wonderful. And again, what is your website where people can contact you?
It's conscioushealth.ca. One last interesting fact, Dr. Mark Starr found out of all his patients, 1,600, that desiccated thyroid increases immunity and allows the body to fight off infections, and almost none of his patients have heart problems when that is corrected. So there's lots of good information that people can check on and search on their own. Become your own researcher.
Thank you so much, Ron. And is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close the show?
No, I think we've covered an awful lot of information. I hope it hasn't been information overload, Marie.
Well, that's the great thing about the show is that you can go back and hear the podcast. If there's anything that you've kind of glazed over because it's too much information, you can go back and listen to it again at blogtalkradio.com/namasteradio. So thank you so much, Ron Garner, for being with us.
You're most welcome. It was a pleasure, Marie.
Take care. Have a wonderful day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, that was Ron Garner. He is the author of the book Conscious Health, and you can find that at namastepublishing.com. You can also go to his website, consciousHealth.ca. And this is the third in our series, the third and final in our series of discussions on conscious health with Ron Garner. So if you've missed the first and second, please do go back into the Blog Talk Radio Namaste Radio archive, and you can listen to the other two episodes. Thank you so much for being with us. If you enjoyed this show, please rate the show and share it with someone. Tell someone about it, post it on your blog, whatever way that you would like to share it, please do so. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be back next week. We'll be speaking with Sue Frederick, and she can see your dream job. She is a career intuitive. It's going to be a really exciting hour, so please do tune in for that 1 p.m. Pacific here on Namaste Radio next Tuesday. Be well. Thank you for tuning in. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.